It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy Fanny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And we have two special guests today. We have Diana Foe.
Hello.
Hi.
Your lip chat.
Hello.
And Andrew's been on here before, but now he's got the book is like actually coming, so we'll be talking about that. It's turned in. It's coming. So why don't we start? We'll start with you, Diana. Just take a moment to kind of tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, obviously, the Beyond Victoriana. Well, kind of.
First, let's just say that Diana has awesome hair.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, for right now in this light, it is probably either sea green or sky blue. Yeah. For some reason, the intention of the dye is it's sky blue in the box, but depending on like whether it's like I guess fluorescent lighting or not. Get yellow tones, but I'm like, either way, it looks cool. I'm pretty happy with it.
It looks great. It kind of actually has different tones on different parts of your head right now.
Yeah, so I'm just gonna go with it. Like, this is cool. Bye. But, I work for Tor Books as an editor. I also blog for Tor.com, and I also am pretty active in the steampunk community. My steampunk name, and I have no shame, you can Google this, is Alien the Peacemaker, and I run the oldest running blog on multicultural steampunk, which is Beyond Victoriana. You can just look it up, beyondvictoriana.com. And I've been part of that community for about 7 years. So.
Excellent. So, real quick, we'll have you just, Andrew, jump in and say a little bit about yourself so folks can know who you are. Everything.
Well, you didn't say anything about my hair, but I'll delete it. No, it's fabulous.
I'll let everybody know that Andrew's hair is fabulous, and his shirt kind of matches Diana's hair.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go. It works out.
We planned that. I'm Andrew Liptak. I am the co-editor of the War Stories Anthology, which is coming out from Apex Books. I have fiction forthcoming from Galaxy's Edge magazine, and I write a science fiction history column for Kirkus Reviews.
Which you have, I don't know if you can, you announce that you're working on a thing book?
Yes.
Okay.
Through Jurassic London, I'm writing, basically taking the column and adapting it to a history of science fiction. So that'll be coming out probably sometime in 2015.
Okay, that's so we've got a long time, but it's
so
going to be
like
awesome.
A comprehensive history of science fiction?
Ish.
Wow.
Yeah, it's going to be, he was telling me a bit about it, so we'll talk, I think, a bit about that here, too. So, oh my goodness, where are
so
we going to start?
So, I have a question for Diana. So, one of the things that we're, our theme for 2014 as a podcast is that we're exploring science fiction and fantasy all around the world and in different cultures and in different countries. And you just mentioned that you have run this multicultural steampunk blog and are active in that community. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what, like, the driving force of the blog is and what kinds of things you explore beyond Victoriana, because that is, of course, what everybody defaults to with steampunk.
Yeah, the blog was actually started after the whole Reidsville conversations of 2009. Where people are always talking about, oh, what does representation mean? What does it mean to have accessible platforms for people of different backgrounds and all that stuff? So I was part of the steampunk community, and it was one of the things that I've noticed, but other people have noticed, whether, does it glorify imperialism? Is it all about empire? Because all we see is white people running around in pith helmets, pretending to go on adventures with the queen. And I got into it, actually. It's fascinating, well, only to me, but I guess to you too, but it was my fiancé who got me into steampunk, because she was with a group of friends who were into it, but they weren't into it because of the books. They got into it because of RPGs and, you know, and role-playing. And so how she described steampunk to me was a type of performance. And I have a big interest in theater. I have a master's in performance studies. So I was always like, oh, wow, theater, this is awesome. But I didn't want to have like some sort of performance persona that glorified colonialism. Mm. I can remember having a conversation with one of her friends, and I said, well, I don't know whether like I feel very comfortable with the whole colonial aspect. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, it really shouldn't be a problem because we, you know, even though we're in America, we can pretend America is part of the colonies too. And I'm like, well, that's kind of some point. So after the whole race bill conversations, I had this project about what does steampunk mean? And essentially, it means to me the role of industrialization and how it changes society. And it and that is happening constantly, not only in the 19th century, but even today, if we look at the various parts of the non-Western world, you know, the current industrial revolution is happening in places like China and Africa, you know, in India. It's still so relevant to our conversations of how we use technology and how it affects daily lives, and not only in a localized sense, but in a globalization sense, especially with, like, you know, new media technologies being able to transmit information about our situations so much more quickly. So I started Beyond Victoriana specifically to look at the intersection of the West and the non-West when it came to, you know, not just steampunk, which is very specific, but how, you know, technological changes happen in society. And I liked, you know, so it does play fast and loose the definition of steampunk. I look at stuff from the 19th century, I look at stuff from this century, I look at stuff from post-APOC or secondary fantasy worlds, and I just observe what artists' creations, what books, what movies, and what history and articles are out there that talk about this form of retrofuturism. And, yeah, I've been doing it since 2009, and it's been a pretty cool ride so far.
So, on that subject, I know that you've obviously talked about books that are being written with this sort of, presumably with this kind of a perspective. Well, could you recommend any... maybe books that are being written by people from elsewhere, or who are at least just delving into some of these issues.
Yeah, certainly. I recommend like a series of short stories. Like I was a certain
short
stories. Yeah, steam powered lesbian
right.
steampunk stories.
Yeah.
You know, not only because they address different types of sexuality, but you know, in the, like the third volume, they also incorporate
like,
other like
I think even from
cultures,
the first volume,
nations.
Other cultures are
yeah.
represented.
Haiti, N.K. Jemisin has one on Haiti.
Yeah, the Ethnoengine
yes.
engine was
yeah.
in the first one, and
yeah.
I think there were other ones from China and other places as well. I
yeah.
think in the second volume, Shwetanarayan had a story.
Right.
So.
And so, and I find it fascinating. I see more great examples in short works. And, of course, there's novels, too. And I guess to plug in an upcoming project, I actually wrote the introduction to Steampunk World, which is edited by Sarah Hans. It's coming out from Alliteration, Inc. And that, you know, specifically takes, you know, all different types of stories from all different parts of the globe and... You know, I read it all before the introduction. It's absolutely fantastic. So I'm really excited when that finally comes out. Other works I recommend. There's some really great. There's a great graphic novel series called Virtuoso. I think it's currently on hiatus, but it reimagines. A type of like secondary fantasy world that's set in an African Art Deco, you know, style aesthetic,
Ooh.
And it talks in this empire. They take all their inventors, they lock them up, and all they can do is design weapons. Until one woman, instead of inventing, you know, a new form of gun, she invents a portable printing press, and she has it escape out into the larger world, and it changes everything. So those are the type of stories that really interest me. Another good example that I talk about is Paul Guinan and Anna Bennett's Boilerplate and the Adventures of Frank Reed. And those are actually counter-narrative histories, so it looks like they're big coffee table books, and they're gorgeous. And the first book, Boilerplate, follows this robot who was invented supposedly to end all wars, because it was... And the inventor wanted to have this type of robot to function and fight wars instead of soldiers. And he ends up going all around the world, and he hangs out with all sorts of people. He hangs out with, like, the Buffalo Soldiers. He saves the Queen of Hawaii. There for the Boxer Rebellion. And the point that the authors want to do with, like, Boilerplate is to show other histories that don't normally get included in American history books. Mm-hmm. Oh. And those types of adventures. And Frank Reed is the companion book to that, which actually Frank Reed is... he's actually a dime novel character, like a legitimate one from the literature. But they kind of retell his story as like a parallel because his family were like super imperialistic inventors. But then you see, like, between the lines, because it's told from the point of view of Frank Reed's, like, granddaughter, like, looking through her family archives, and so it has this interesting retrospective point of view that looks like what her ancestors did, and what was good, what was bad, and that was also really fascinating. So I always like to recommend those to start with. I know other more popular authors have incorporated more, you know, multicultural aspects in their works, like Scott Leviathan's Scott Westerfield's Leviathan trilogy. You know, definitely it takes place on the eve of and into the early years of World War I. But they also get to travel through Turkey to Japan into Russia. I also liked to recommend Sherry Priest's Clockwork Century series, which had been like a milestone in itself in, like, you know, in steampunk literature, modern steampunk literature.
A new book just came out this year.
Yes, Fiddlehead. And that kind of wraps up the current arc that she has. But for those who aren't familiar with it, it is set in frontier Seattle where the Civil War has lasted 10 years too long, and when an adventurer experiments with his new mining drill, it leaches yellow gas into Seattle, you know, a bunch of people die, then they come back to life. So, frontier Seattle, zombies, Civil War, it's great. I always recommend it to people who've never read any steampunk books before and want something, because I think it touches upon all the things that steampunk books, you know, that I like would have, which would be, like, it's fun adventure story, but also has, you know, protagonists you don't normally see in speculative fiction, young women, middle-aged women, single mothers, working class, people of color. You know, they have characters who are queer, characters who are mixed race, and it deals with alternate history, in a playful way where you could still have fun, but also realize the gravity of history is still there. So those are the ones that I would have off the top of my head.
Have you read Moorcock's Warlord of the Air?
Yes.
Okay.
And actually,
I feel like people should read that.
Yes, they should. Yeah, they should. And funny story, because Alien the Peacemaker, I actually chose that steampunk name, particularly because I wanted to play off Eastern Westerns, and you know how, like, sharpshooters always have, like, that clever nickname. So I'm like, oh, it's the Peacemaker. And then later I read World of the Air and I'm like, oh wait, the half Chinese, like, inventor guy, his nickname was also the Peacemaker. And that's totally coincidental, I swear. So
it's a really fascinating book. Have you read it, Andrew?
I thought.
Oh, it's,
I have read Sherry Priest's books, but I'm not very well versed in steampunk.
Oh, that's okay. You're gonna read this one now, Warlord of the Air.
I'll add it to the growing pile.
The growing pile. It's a really fascinating book. It features a guy who, presumably by magic, he ends up in the future of his own time. It's a post-Victorian era, and basically the empire, British Empire and other empires, have, like, everything is wonderful, right? That's his first experience. It's all wonderful. They have great medical technology. They got these airships. They can fly everywhere really quick. They got these, like, train tubes. Everything looks great until he gets sort of kidnapped by this guy named General Shaw, who is this Chinese, half-Chinese warlord, who everybody says is a horrible human being, and that's when his vision of what is real...
Utopia becomes dystopia.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating book. I wrote a paper on it recently, which might be why.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. But anyways.
So I would like to hear a little bit about Andrew's projects. I know that you are working on War Stories. You just turned in the draft mm-hmm. for that. And yesterday mm-hmm. you were telling me that your concept of this was a little bit different than the military science fiction that people would expect for this, like, Bane.
Yes. Going into my co-editor and I, J.M. Gates, did... we wanted to basically focus on soldiers and the impact, rather than the actual actions of warfare, where you have, you go and you shoot things and you get your mission done. And that's perfectly fine. I'm not making a judgment on those types of stories. But we wanted to show what happens to the people who are going into doing the shooting. And so what we did is we put a call out for authors. We got more than 200 submissions. Sean submitted a good one, and we got out of those 200 submissions, we had a really great pile of stories that are now in the final table of contents. So the overall theme of the anthology is I hesitate to say progressive science fiction, but more soldier-centric, and the impact of war on soldier-centric sort of stories. We've divided the anthology up into four pieces, and the table of contents is going to shift, but the first one we have is Aftermath, and these are five or six stories that take place after war has ended. Soldiers who have come back, and here at ICFA, we've Brett Cox read his story, which was pretty well received, and it's about a soldier who she was a foot soldier on the ground, and she comes home, and she's having a lot of trouble dealing with it. We have some other really good stories that have people coming back home, and where they have loved ones who are deployed, not even overseas, but out of the solar system, and how they are dealing with it and all that. So there's some good ones there, and we have a section that we call combat stories. And these are stories that basically deal with soldiers that are in the field, and they are dealing with stresses while they are, combat is a very stressful place. It's not recommended if you have high blood pressure. The third section is mechs and power armor, because it's what military science fiction anthology cannot have power armor. I have issues with it sometimes, but I really like the idea of people suiting up and going around blasting things with weapons that are too big to be held by a normal person. And we have some really interesting technological stories versus non-technological enemy. And then the final section, and as I said, these will probably shift orders, is systems warfare, and that's not really a good way to describe it, but it's basically the idea of electronic systems or warfare as a systemized practice, and that includes drones, that includes electronics and stuff like that. So there's a good variety. We didn't really want stuff that was hugely jingoistic, stuff that was really like, raw America is the, in space is the best thing ever. And I'm not saying that to say that America is terrible, but I'm saying that there's other points of view beyond American science fiction. And there's a lot of science fiction that is in the vein of Starship Troopers, and we didn't really want to do just that. So that's something we sort of made a point to encourage our authors to look beyond just what has been done and to see what else is to be done.
Do you have any stories that are by authors who are not Americans?
We do. Carlos Orsi is from Brazil. Noreen Dorman, I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She is from South Africa. We have Karen Lawachi, who is from Canada.
She's a great author. She also wrote this wonderful novel called Gaslight Dogs.
Yes, and she and I have talked quite a bit, and I am, when I set out to do this, she was the person I said I have to have Karen in this anthology. And she was somebody I really asked to come in, and she was thrilled to come in for this. So and her story is fantastic. I'm a huge fan of what she put together for us. Mike Sizemore, he's from England.
Thoraya Dyer? Yeah, she's Australian.
Her story actually takes place in Jordan.
Jordan?
Yeah.
Okay, and just making sure.
We also have a bunch of authors who wrote stories that were outside of the U.S. And Rich Larson, who won the Dell Award here at this conference, he wrote a story called Ghost Girl, which takes place in South Africa, which is also quite good, and it actually deals with albinism and some of the giant robots.
Is Rich originally from South Africa?
He is. Like he's from South Africa, he's now living in Canada.
Canada, right.
Interesting.
Mark Jacobson, he's actually a currently serving Air Force officer. He has published a story that takes place in the near future Syria, which is we thought was interesting because it's very relevant right now. If it's still around at the time, in the next couple of years, we'll see. Mike Beretta, he's an author who's also, he served on an aircraft carrier. He wrote a very weird story. It has a lot to do with sort of in the Jeff Vandermeer type of weird. It's got a lot of fungus. And a lot to do with genetic engineering, but it has a very weird tinge to it. And it's a very one of the ones I read. And I'm like, this is a really good story. We have to keep it.
I'm just like, I'm sorry. I love that you're like, it's a Jeff Vandermeer type story. And you're like, what does that mean? It's got fungi.
I just read Annihilation, and that's sort of what came to mind after reading that.
Was there fungi in that too?
Ish. Yeah. It's a very weird story.
He certainly loves his fungi. I think. Yeah.
It's so funny because I actually had I was hanging out with Jeff when he was in New York during his Annihilation tour, and he was commenting during his talk that, you know, first, depending on whatever he's currently doing, people know him as that blank guy. So he's either like, oh, that anthology guy or that editor guy, and now he's the fungi guy.
We also have a couple of known military science fiction authors. T.C. McCarthy, he published a trilogy of military sci-fi books, which were quite good.
Joe Haldeman, you have.
Joe Haldeman. We have a reprint from Joe. That's at the beginning of the book Graves, which we really liked. Linda Nagata, whose novel was just nominated for Nebula, her story actually ties into the novel, and that one's a quite good one. Jane Ann Spendlove, she's actually currently serving, Coast Guard or Air Force? I'm drawing a blank. But she's written some military science fiction before, and she's sort of known in that field. And Carol Lawachi, I sort of consider her a military sci-fi writer because of some of the themes that her books take on are very military-like. We've got Ken Lau, James Cambias, who just published a book through Tor, which is
Darkling,
The Darkling Sea.
Darkling Sea, which I have now.
Which is quite a good read. I really enjoyed that one. Jake Kerr, James Sutter, Yoon-Ha Lee, and...
Yoon-Ha Lee is amazing.
Yes. Sorry, I love you.
I'm missing people. Jay Posey wrote a really good story for us. Maurice brought us. Richard Jansky, Susan Jane Bigelow.
I love Susan Jane.
We have a really good group of authors, and I'm very. What I'm going to say is, so I'm really happy with the book we have put together.
So that's awesome. What kinds of war scenarios are we dealing with? Is it mostly Earth-centric, or is it mostly space?
Going down the list, Ken's story has to do with drones. There's stories that take place with robots in South Africa. We've got Syria. We've got some intelligent weapons. We've got snipers in Jordan, power armor on other planets. We've got fungus in Florida.
Of course.
I'm glad it has alliteration, too.
Yeah. Maybe we should have titled it that. We have barbecues in the middle of winter in Canada. It takes place all over the place. We didn't look for just Earth, near-Earth war stories that take place in Afghanistan or Iraq. There's a lot of connections to those conflicts because they're very recent, but we also looked all over the place. And there's influences all over.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's got great cover art, and it's got great stories. I hope people will buy it, and people will enjoy it.
So when's that going to be available for purchase?
Backers will get it in May. They've already pretty much pre-purchased it. The main edition that we'll publish through Apex is going to be, we're going to strip out some of the artwork, and that should be available later this year.
Okay.
There's some interior artwork for the Kickstarter backers because they backed it a little bit of a higher level.
Okay, so it sounds like we have some common ground here with Karen Loachy and Sherry Priest, where like both of you have read these and seem to enjoy them. I want to talk a little bit about, I want you to talk a little bit about why those books worked for you. Like, you said that you think of Karen Loachy as writing military SF.
Ish. I mean, military
which is not what
SF
I would first come up
as
with.
A genre is a very small subset. She deals with some military issues. Her first book, War Child, has to do with child soldiers. Her other book, The Gaslight Dogs, has a lot to do with sort of frontier soldiers and exploration. There's tangential things, and my background is in military history. There is warfare touches on every aspect of society, depending on how you look at it. There's social issues, there's exploration issues, technological issues. So it can be very broad, and it can encompass a lot of things. And that's sort of how I'm viewing her as military, because military touches in
okay.
It's background.
I think the only one that I've read is The Gaslight Dogs. Is that the correct title? And so I was sort of like, I wouldn't have consider that as mil SF, but I mean, I guess it does.
Well, if you were to put it in the place of being on the American frontier, it would have been very much so a military book.
Yeah.
Because you had a lot of military activity in the American frontier in the late 1870s or so, and that's sort of about where it sort of takes place there. I'm not sure how to classify that book. It's sort of steampunk. It's sort of not. It's a very unique entry, and I really liked it because it was very, very different.
Yeah. So, how do you feel about it, Diana?
So, I mean, I really like that book too, and what drew me in actually is that I thought it was a really great example of a book that addressed settler colonialism, mm-hmm. you know, from the indigenous perspective, mm-hmm. and and that's what I think steampunk doesn't really like talk about, especially when they talk about like his certain inspiration from historical time periods of how colonialism worked, mm-hmm. and that, and it worked on many different forms, and affected many different groups of peoples in different ways, and and I think that Karen did a really interesting job that dealt with first, this type of encroaching colonialism from the perspective of this girl that, like, you know, that she had no vocabulary to fully, like, understand it. You know, she was, like, the intelligent woman, and she was, and she does, like, all these amazing things, but... And that's why I think that's what really drew me in, because very often when we hear about frontier stories, it's always from the frontiersman's point of view or a cowboy's point of view. And they always use this language that, like, oh, we're off trying to find our own space, or to conquer the wild, wild west or whatever. and it doesn't really, like, account for, like, the fact that, no, you're actually coming and invading my home.
Right.
And I just think that was mm-hmm. dealt really well. And I have a love for wolves, so that helped a lot, too.
And on top of all that, Karen is an absolutely extraordinary writer. She does not have the level of visibility that she deserves. All of her books have been absolutely astounding, and her short fiction is absolutely astounding. I love pretty much everything I've read by her.
Which explains why she's in your anthology. You probably, like, wrote little messages like, you please send me something.
I told her very early on, I emailed her and said, Karen, I would really like you to be part of this, and she was, fortunately, she was very amicable doing that.
That's awesome.
And she actually sent us one story, and it was good, and then she sent me, she said, no, I'm going to take it back, I'm going to do a different one, and she wrote one that was even better. I hope the other one makes the light of day somewhere if she can recycle it, but... This one absolutely blew us away. Like, from the first reading, I was like, yes, this is perfect.
Awesome. I've got two questions, but they're not related, so I'm just going to ask Diana the one that's for you, and then I'll ask Andrew the other one. I'm assuming you're familiar with Mike Resnick's weird Western books.
I'm familiar with them. I actually haven't read them. I do have... an interest in Weird West, but it's kind of like, I kind of think it's tangential to, like, but I have read works, like, I loved Felix Gildman's Half-Made World, and of course I love the Sherry Priest books, which could be classified as that, but I actually haven't delved much into the Weird West stuff as I should, but,
The reason I bring it up is, because obviously, you've written, I think in 2010 you wrote an essay or two that were very
I don't know what the word I'm looking for, but they had a almost not quite having a manifesto for what steampunk maybe should do, but like a call for, like, we need more multicultural steampunk that throws away this idea of, you know, like, imperialism as something we're supposed to celebrate, that they should be complicated to some extent. I forget the title of the exact essay, but I'll hunt it down somewhere.
Okay, I originally wrote it for, I think I know what you're talking about, you know, steampunks around the world unite.
Yeah.
It was like, it was this big thing that I wrote. It was first posted on this blog called Free the Princess, run by Matt Delman, and then it's reposted onto Steampunk Magazine. And I think that's how it got, like, a wider distribution from there.
Yeah, and there was a lot of discussion about that, and when I was thinking about the Mike Resnick book, because they're essentially, they're Weird West, but they're basically just steampunk. And one of the interesting things is, I think Resnick's intention is to write them as though they're, like, dime novel adventure stories, so, like, they're supposed to be somewhat ironic. But yet, at the same time, when you read these novels, they very clearly, like, it's the U.S. versus, like, U.S. using all these weird techno gadgets they've come up with like, Thomas Edison and that kind of thing, versus Native Americans using some form of magic. I'm not exactly sure what kind of magic it is. And having that same frontier battle, but in that, it almost on the one hand, like, a pulpy level, but at the same time, it's still that narrative that we already know. Of the kind of Western expansion and just sort of taking shit that doesn't belong to you. And so I'm curious where you think, if there is room, where do we place works within steampunk? Like, how do we deal with works that are trying to be ironic, or I say ironic because I'm not so sure it's satire, but ironic with these kinds of tropes that obviously have problems when they're taken seriously?
And I think that's all a question. I think that boils down to what you're asking, like, oh, how can we deal with quote-unquote historical accuracy?
That's another gap.
You know, when people think of something being historical accurate, they also think, oh, versus something that's quote-unquote politically correct. But actually, what would be historically correct is to show, like, how crappy things actually have gone on during the time period, and not trying to glorify, you know, or romanticize something. And what I think happens, you know, and this is actually a question that can be linked to greater conversations currently happening in the sci-fi fantasy community about appropriation and about, like, oh, you know, can we write the other? How can we write them in a fair and just way? Is it our right to tell certain stories or not? And what I think the more important question to ask is, what message do you want your art to send? And secondly, what is the effects of your work upon your reader, upon the people you're writing about or becoming inspired by? And it's a question of ethics. And I think now more than ever, because you can get, like, instant feedback via the Twitter or, like, on Facebook or whatever, that the role of the storyteller and the creator and their ethics and how they conduct their art become more and more important. And that's when you get, like, you know, different ideas about it. Like, it is a long-held idea that, like, oh, separate the author from their work. And I believe that. I believe you should separate from the author from their work. However, if the reader has certain critiques about their work, how is the author going to respond? That is an ethical question that everyone has to be able to deal with on their own. You know? And I guess, like, on a side note, if you know, whenever someone does something, like, ironically or satirically, you should also remember that, like, you know, satire punches up. So if you end up like, oh, it's satire, but you're actually making fun of an already marginalized or disenfranchised group, it's not satire. You're just siding with, you know, the dominant narrative already, and you're still making the joke at expense from people who don't have power anyways. So those are my thoughts.
Interesting. Awesome.
I just agree with everything she said.
All right. Okay, so then totally different train of thought then is for Andrew.
because you, I know we've talked a little bit off podcast like about the, your interest in military history, and I think it's fairly obvious that this has an influence on why you're doing an anthology on military sci-fi. But I'm curious, as somebody who has studied military history and considers himself a historian in this field, and somebody who is, of course, writing a book on the history of science fiction, what are some things that you think that we're, as a genre, are not being discussed within military SF? Or maybe an alternate question is, what have we focused too much on?
I think we focused a little too much on just the sheer action. But I think that there's... I think a couple of years ago I wrote a piece for IO9. It was a little snotty, but it was, your military science fiction isn't military science fiction. And I sort of made a point that a lot of the military science fiction doesn't really look at, it's not about the military. It's more about larger political ideas, typically anti-fascism or anti-dictatorship sort of stories. But there's either a combination of military stories that don't really, they sort of take an idea of the military and run with it, and in some cases authors have either served in the military to some capacity or they're influenced heavily by it. I wrote this after I had done a lot of, you know, studied a lot of theorists in the military field and how does warfare actually work and what warfare actually is. So in a lot of ways, military science fiction isn't about war. It's about individual people fighting a war, or people fighting an ideal, playing out a part in a fight against an ideology. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's points of that where, you know, I hope that I've seen a couple of books that sort of look at warfare that's actually fairly accurate in that it's a system, and basically warfare is a political action. Just you're basically, you have politicians telling your soldiers to go there and make that person stop doing that by any means necessary. Look at what's happening in Russia and Crimea. Russia has basically said, we want that place and we're going to take it. It's a bloodless war because nobody's been, well, but one officer's been shot. But so far, Crimea is sort of ceding it by taking people out. If that makes sense in one way, it's not just about people going and shooting each other. There's a lot of baggage behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
There's a lot of baggage that's motivating them. Now, the what motivates soldiers is a different thing altogether. You have people who are either very patriotic, they want to protect their country because they earnestly believe that what they're doing is good, and in a lot of cases, what they are doing is good. If you look at the World War II example. Or they believe that they're doing good, and that really, that belief comes down to what you're, you know, about the conflict in general. You also have not only the political motivations of your soldiers, but you have the immediate motivation of staying alive and helping the people around you. And so there's a couple of different layers here. Most soldiers will say that they hate what they do. They don't want to get shot at, and nobody wants to get shot at. But they are there because they are the best people for the job, and they can help save their friends. And they can make sure that everybody that is around them, or most of them, can live to see another day and make it home. That's basically what every soldier wants to do, is to go home. And sometimes you will probably get some, in fiction you'll probably, or even in real life, you'll probably get some people who just want to kill. And in that case, that's a different story altogether. And, you know, there's a sort of a psychopath thing that's going on, but
okay.
I know the army screens out people like that, so I don't think there's people who are like, yes, I want to go out and kill people. They get pumped up to do that, but there's not people who are really like pathologically going out to do that, at least as far as I know.
At least you hope not. Yeah,
but then you get instances of where you see people not showing very much empathy, and that's either been drilled out of them on an institutional level, because you do have to dehumanize, or in Alien's case, it's literally dehumanized, or actually, they're literally not human, in order to make sure your thing is done. But at the same time, you have people, you have instances like Aqua Grave, where you have some absolute dehumanization goes very, very far, and you see some very horrific things happen, and you know, that happens, that has happened in every war. Anytime people start hitting each other for things that they don't like.
Yeah, yeah.
I know this is like the classic easy example, but I love The Forever War. I think Forever War is one of the best science fiction novels.
Yep.
And I love how it actually addresses, like, almost pretty, like, the first battle they go to, the first thing that happens is the commander says, you're all going to go out there and fight and shoot these aliens, but just in case you don't want to do it, I'm going to turn on the subliminal message in your brain, and you're going to do it anyway, whether you like it or not. And so it basically, that's what happens, is that all of these images of these aliens, like, well, they're images that aren't even of the actual aliens. They're made up ones because nobody knows what they look like.
Yep.
So they make them up, and they've got these, like, gorged members, and they're, like, raping women and killing children and eating their brains and just doing this horrible stuff. So it drives them all into a frenzy to commit what is essentially a fairly heinous act of killing all of these people, but it makes them so they just don't. They'd have no empathy anymore because
there's an element of dehumanization for an enemy is that you need to make sure that when you were given an order, you carry it out and you can't stop. So if your commander tells you you need to shoot that thing over there, you do that without questioning because there's a level of trust there that, you know, your chain of command knows what they're doing and they're doing it for the right reasons. It's your job is not to ask why. Your job is to carry that out. In this case, it's a very systemized thing. You are carrying out an action that has been basically determined by somebody that's not you. So that's sort of where that dehumanization comes in from. And then that's why you'll hear soldiers say things about, you know, people who are from Iraq or Afghanistan that are pretty horrible, but it's sort of the only way they can do what they're supposed to do. And there's cases where it is taken too far.
Yeah, but at the same time,
that's also happened to every war
ever
committed.
Yeah, well,
that person over there, we don't like them. They did this to your mother. Oh, well, I don't like them. So,
Diana was talking a lot about colonialism and the sort of idea that we do have all these stories where we glorify empires and we sort of romanticize it and we sweep under all of the conquest that's happened before. In your military history studies, do you focus on, like, what kind of history are you
studying? I focus mostly on World War II.
Okay, so that's
My background is in military history, and I attended the first private military college in the United States. I didn't attend as a cadet. There's a civilian component there, but Norwich University, where I attended, and I actually work there now, has a very long history with warfare ever since it was started in 1819. Every single conflict since that date that has the United States has marched on, we've been had a person there. And we have several commanders. In World War II, this guy named General Ernest Harmon, who commanded the 2nd Armored Division. I've focused a bit on him, and I think I've written my master's thesis was on, or master's capstone project was on the links between the space race and the Cold War, and how they intersected, how we couldn't really have one without the other. It's a little bit diverse, but I didn't really focus on, you know, the ideas of empires or conquests. That sort of is a given. People at home don't like to think about, you know, the terrible things you have to do at war. And
I think that spreads out to more than war. I mean, I think the fact that my genes were probably made somewhere far away from here by people who were not being paid well.
Yep.
And yet I have to buy clothing because I need to wear clothing. So I kind of just do it and on a day-to-day basis. I mostly try not to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
When I do think about it, then I try to, when I can, make better decisions about what I buy and try to make decisions that won't necessarily support that system, but it's so big that I can't quite always just escape it. I have to be part of it. So I was wondering, Diana, like, in your steampunk stuff, do you see a lot of that kind of thing being examined?
There's a great quote that Cory Doctorow, so I'm not going to quote him exactly about it because I don't have that good of a memory, about why he loves steampunk. And he loves it. He says, I'm paraphrasing here, because it's so complicated, because you have this you know, this community that's all, they're makers, they're all into DIY and doing things yourselves. So you make your costumes and stuff, but you make your costumes out of, like, painted Nerf guns or made in, like, way back in China by these children in some factory, and no one ever thinks about that. And he's like, and that's why I love steampunk, and that's Cory Doctorow. But I think that there are a lot of people in the community who do, who are self-reflective, but there could always be more. And it's also hard because I consider myself like, oh, because I like politics and I involve politics in how I interact with fandom, they're like, oh my gosh, you're like an extremist. You're like one of those, like, those people. I'm like, well, no, I just like to talk about implications of what you do. And, you know, and I do have to admit that, like, a large part of the community does use it as a form of wish fulfillment, or does try to use it as some form of, like, Victorian Ren Faire sort of thing, which, you know, I believe that could be so much more. And there are many other people who believe the same. But those people also tend to overlap into other groups. They tend to be radically identified. They tend to be more heavily involved in the maker community, which is more politically aware, than as well as the general steampunk community. Especially in steampunk literature, like, authors are super, super aware about the consequences of these imperialist attitudes and playing with history and subverting it. And that's what I really appreciate. And I'm slowly seeing that more and more as being, like, a given in understanding about what steampunk, quote-unquote, ideology could be. And it'll be fascinating to see where it actually transforms from there.
Okay, so I have one last question, then we got to wrap up.
I also do costuming. I basically do costume of a member of a fascist empire. I do stormtrooper costume. We are the epitome of fascist imperialists, because that's what they
do. Charity.
We do a lot of charity. I mean, there is a little bit of introspection of, you know, well, you guys do realize that you are representing some really bad people. Well, you know, that's true, but, you know, stormtrooper costumes are really fucking cool. I like doing it, and kids like it, and, you know, there's some ideology behind it, but, you know, it doesn't really come through on that level, at least from our perspective.
Do you make your own costumes?
Yes, for the most part.
I guess what I would say about that is, when we're dealing with Star Wars, we're dealing with a world that does not exist in any... Like, it obviously has analogs.
There's a lot of real-world parallels, though.
There are certainly real-world parallels, but when we're dealing with, like in a lot of steampunk, it's dealing with real-world people. I mean, obviously in a fictional setting. So maybe the implications have a different impact?
They're further removed.
I feel like I would definitely have a different visceral reaction to seeing someone as a stormtrooper versus seeing someone who decided to cosplay as a Nazi.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I would feel much more uncomfortable with the Nazi cosplay than I would with the stormtrooper cosplay.
Yeah, and we've had odd encounters with people because the Imperial officers from Star Wars look really a lot like Nazis in some places. The uniforms are very similar, and that's no coincidence.
Right.
The Empire are the bad guys. Even though we do have cookies, they're still bad.
Look, the stormtroopers are totally misunderstood. We now know they're clones.
I haven't seen this for years.
They're clones. Most of them are clones. They don't know any better. They've been raised to be, you know, ruthless killing machines that can't shoot straight, right?
Yeah, any time on the Death Star in A New Hope, they basically played into the big plan that Darth Vader had, so they weren't all that clueless.
But they thought they were doing what was right.
When they went to Endor, they were issued the wrong kit. They were not set up to fight an insurgency. Just worked.
Okay, so my last question is kind of like out of left field, but Diana, you're wearing a Batman hoodie. And Batman is not at all steampunk and also not really military SF, and yet there's this, like, crossover there with Batman and Iron Man both, where they're basically these really rich guys who have made their own armor out of, like, all this technology that they can afford to buy. So how does that fit into the whole picture? And I want just both of you to give a quick little thought.
Well, the new Iron Man movies were actually very... The first Iron Man movie was great because it really looked into the military-industrial complex. Mm. You know, you've got a wealthy industrialist who makes bombs for a living and gets to make his own little toys. There's a lot of there's a lot you can look into for that, for how warfare is basically produced now, which I thought, and I thought it was nice bits of commentary there. I mean, granted, there you've got a guy flying around in a pseudo-military suit. Batman is a little similar. I mean, in the new movies that they did, they sort of show that he's got a lot of ties to the military industry, and that his suit was basically an advanced, I don't remember the exact thing it was an advanced combat infantry suit or something. So, yeah, that warfare is very profitable.
Would you consider it fits in with military SF?
Not really, because Iron Man and Batman don't really address military issues. I mean, the first Iron Man movie kind of sort of, because it does sort of play into some elements of insurgency combat, but not really, because they're not really military. Yes, they use the military elements, but there's sort of a step over for military science fiction, and military science fiction is a genre with its own little conventions in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
But what I would say is that because Iron Man and Batman have so many similarities, you know, you could say that they're basically the same. They basically have the same conversations with the meanings of their stories. But I think they're actually like they are different angles on larger systematic problems. Like Iron Man is more international. Like, you know, because the Iron Man, you know, character has always been a commentary about the U.S. You know,
it came out of Vietnam.
Yeah, it came out of Vietnam. It was all about how does the U.S. like fight their foreign enemies, and Batman takes the angle of like how do we take the domestic, our domestic wars, our urban crime, and ironically enough, like the overall like messages that they superficially said, oh, one man can do it. Bootstrap individualism. Just suit them up and they can shoot them all down. And it's a total, like, no, that method doesn't actually work at all.
They're trying.
Yeah.
A lot of the military equipment they're building right now, they're trying to get fewer and fewer soldiers onto the battlefield because, you know, fewer people get killed. Yeah. Look at the whatever the latest jet is. It can do everything, but it doesn't work.
Oh, that. 35 yeah. or 20 whatever yeah we yeah. spent 32 yeah. trillion bazillion dollars on two yeah.
Well, it's designed to do a whole, it's designed to fill a whole lot of points on the battlefield, and unfortunately it doesn't quite do all of them. So if they had done two or three different types of jets, it probably would have been a lot more successful and probably would have been a lot more cheap.
Well, look on the bright side, Mitt Romney can buy it and use it as a cup holder.
Okay.
A really complicated cup holder.
How's that a bright side?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
See the bright side there.
We're all staring at
exactly.
Sean.
Exactly. I thought you were going to say, oh, in the bright 5 years, Amazon will just use it for all their deliveries.
Exactly.
That's also bright, so we can look forward to that too.
Okay.
Although they probably, yeah.
Okay. We do have to wrap up really quickly. Where can we find you and your work?
So we'll start
with Diana.
All right. As I said, for beyondvictoriana.com is the website for multicultural steampunk. I also blog for tor.com under my steampunk name, Aileen the Peacemaker. You can also just find me at Tor Books. And I actually, I actually am considering manuscripts. I know, I was wondering 2 seconds, oh my gosh, should I say that? Should I say that not? But yeah, you can find me on Tumblr. Writer Syndrome is the name of the Tumblr. That's also the name of my Twitter. And you can stop by, say hi, drop me a direct message, say what's up. I am totally around.
Drone? So. Can we contact you by drone?
No, you cannot contact me by drone, unfortunately.
They're coming. You're going to be able to get Sam.
If I see a drone, I'd probably like hide. I'd probably like call up, you know, some certain connections of mine and, okay, off the grid now.
Go full steampunk.
Exactly.
Oh, DIY.
And what about you, Andrew? Where can folks find, you know, War Stories and obviously any of your stuff?
You can find War Stories at warstoriesanthology.com. It should be listed through Apex Books and their website. You can follow them at War Stories Antho on Twitter. It's not really updated very much because we've really been focusing on getting that done. I can be found at andrewliptak.com and at andrewliptak on Twitter.
Excellent. All right. Oh, and your Kirkus. How can people find you, your Kirkus stuff?
You can go to the Kirkus Reviews website and go to the articles blog section, and I post every other Thursday there. And if you go to my website, I post up, in addition, I don't post up sources on the article, but on my website. I post what Paul Weimer calls the label, not the label. Album notes.
The liner notes.
That's it. I post the liner notes with all my sources and it's a little bit of background into why I picked that. So you can get to it from there. SF Signal also posts a little blurb about, you know, this article's here. So anyone, Thursday is every other Thursday. Find it there.
Awesome. All right. Well, on that note, guys, thank you, Diana, for coming on and talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yep. And thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, Julia, for being my co-host and in-check.
Thank you, Sean, for having us.
Thank you, Sean. Yeah.
All right. And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.